Whether you like history or not, if you care about bravery, wisdom, passion, larger-than-life characters, and some of the most emotionally intense moments in human experience, you have come to the right place. Daniele Bolelli is a university history professor, writer, and martial artist, and he shall be your guide in a journey to the place where history and epic collide.
Welcome to episode 36 of History on Fire. Today is the beginning of a new series. It's just gonna be two episodes. I was actually gonna plan to do it all in one, but it turns out I need a little extra time to finish the research and make sure I do a good job, so I'd rather break it up in two. So without further ado, let's jump into thanking the good folks who make this episode possible. Well, of course, you guys. Thank you for listening. Without that, there wouldn't be any podcast, so thank you very much for that. Thank you for telling people and all the other good stuff, leaving reviews on iTunes, that kind of thing. Also, this episode is brought to you by Blue Chew. In case you're not yet familiar with the products offered at bluechew.com, what we're talking about is the first chewable with the same FDA-approved active ingredients as Viagra and Cialis. Their stuff is made in the US, prescribed online, and shipped straight to your door. Their goodies work well even on a full stomach, and since they are chewable, they work up to twice as fast as a pill. Now, I mentioned it, this is the second episode that they sponsor. I mentioned it during the first one. I couldn't help, but, you know, my mind couldn't help but wonder, thinking about these particular guys sponsoring a history podcast about the connection between the two. And when I think about the amount of bloodshed and horror that human beings have been unleashing on each other throughout history, kind of makes me wonder if they were armed with some blue chew, if I could just freely distribute it to lots of people ready to chop each other's head off throughout history, if maybe being more satisfied in other areas of their life wouldn't have mellowed them out a little, and we could have skipped a massacre or two. So I guess I'll keep that curiosity, because we'll never know since I don't have a time machine. But what we don't need to be curious about, what we know, is that right now there's a special deal for you guys. Visit bluechew.com and get your first shipment free when you use the promo code HISTORY. Just paid $5 for shipping. Again, that's bluechew.com, promo code HISTORY, to try it for free. This episode is also brought to you by BlueApron.com. In this week's Blue Apron is teaming up with best-selling cookbook author Chrissy Teigen to bring you some of her favorite recipes to make at home. So for 6 weeks, a lot of the goodies shipped by Blue Apron will be Chrissy Teigen recipes. Now with Blue Apron you get insanely good, tasty, pre-portioned ingredients shipped to your door with easy-to-follow step-by-step instructions. They offer about 12 recipes a week, and it's up to you on whether you want to sign up for a plan to receive 2 of them a week, 3 of them a week, 4 of them a week. The good news for you guys, special offer for History on Fire listener, check out this week's menu and you get your first 3 meals for free, which is always a sweet word, 3 free meals at blueapron.com/onfire. Again, that's blueapron.com/onfire to get your first 3 meals free. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Also sponsoring this episode is the Must Triumph podcast. I'm quite happy to be sponsored by Sammy Ang, the author of the Must Triumph podcast, who also happened to be a fellow martial artist, because A, I know him personally, which can always help, and B, because I know him personally, I can vouch that he's a brilliant guy with a sharp mind. His podcast revolves around the theme of self-improvement through any idea that delivers tangible results. It's philosophy, but not the kind of stuffy philosophy often peddled in academia. More of a street brand of philosophy. Philosophy driven by one purpose and one purpose only, which is to elevate the quality of life. In one of the early episodes that I listened, he had me at the sentence, "Philosophers need to learn fighting, and fighters need to learn philosophy." That's exactly my kind of stuff. And I had a chance to listen to all his other episodes so far, and I really can tell you, you know, this guy's good. I really love his material. I dig it, so check him out. It's the Must Triumph podcast. Thank you also to my usual sponsors, my regular from day one, Onnit and Datsusara. Onnit in these days has recently started this 6-week online bodyweight workout program called Onnit 6. Just the other day I had a chance to spend a few hours with their, I love the terminology, chief fitness officer. You know, CFO usually in a company means something else, but Onnit is not like any other company, so they're one of their CFO means Chief Fitness Officer. I love that. That's Mr. John Wolf, the man who put together this online bodyweight workout program. Really great guy, really great program. I started checking it out. I very much like it. You don't need any kind of gimmick. You don't need to buy any equipment. As long as you have enough space to stretch in, you could practice their workouts. They have different levels, beginner, intermediate, advanced, really good stuff. So if you want to check them out, that's at onnit.com/6. Also, you can go to onnit.com/history for any of their supplements or other products where you'll receive an automatic discount. And definitely last but not least, Datsusara with the greatest hemp gear on the planet. Now, one of among the many Datsusara products that I use every day, I will not shy away from saying this, I actually wear fanny packs. Yes, everybody and their grandmother make fun of people wearing fanny packs. I don't care. I need them. They are comfortable for me. I just carry way too much stuff. I mean, my keychain alone, I have probably 32 keys. I probably have the key to the White House or something. I have the keys to everything. I carry from markers that I use at school to my wallet is humongous, by the way, also a Datsusara wallet I have. And those are just the regular items. Then I'm sure, you know, if I dig long enough inside the fanny pack, I can probably find from Japanese infantrymen who are still hiding in the jungle, not knowing that World War II is over and somehow found their way inside my fanny pack and are holding the position there to... you name it. Probably the solution to the Kennedy assassination. Some of the clues are buried in there. There's everything in the universe. So I can't quite put all that stuff in my pockets. Hence the Datsusara fanny pack come to the rescue. Even if you hate fanny packs, they have all sorts of other great products. Backpacks, computer bags, plenty of other goodies. Having said that, I just want to jump into this episode. So if you didn't catch any of the above websites, the links are in the episode notes at historyonfirepodcast.com. But now, without further ado, let's go set history on fire. A quick warning before we get going. The original plan had been to tell this story all in one episode. There are two reasons why that's not going to happen. One, I just need more time for research. You know, and I do like to deliver episodes on a monthly basis. And the simple reality is that I've been working like a dog. I mean, I don't mean to give you the whole sob story, but I basically spend most nights working till 1 or 2 a.m. and it's still incredibly difficult to manage to release episodes on a monthly basis. So I need... it kind of made more sense to break this up in two, so to have a little more time to develop, not to rush anything, not to, you know, allowing me to consult all the sources I want to consult. I feel that does a better job. Also, Reason number two, breaking it in two, gives me a little extra time to dedicate a bit more attention than I had originally anticipated to the cultural context in which the story develops, to tracing at least a sketch of Japanese history, and explore the curious institution of seppuku, the form of ritual suicide favored by the samurai. Had we done it all in one episode, I would have probably rushed that part a little bit more. Instead, in this episode, I'm just gonna kind of introduce the topic, set the stage, prepare the contest, give you the incipit of our story, the beginning of the incident that's going to set everything else in motion, and then we are gonna move on to the main course in about 30 days or so. So that's how we're gonna break it down. Of course, if you are one of those people, and there are quite a few who prefer it this way, would like to listen to the story all at once, well, easy. All you got to do is just hang on for 30 days and play both episodes back to back to get the story all in one shot. Otherwise, if you don't mind getting the beginning now and wrapping things up in about a month, let's go play. Edo, the old name for the city of Tokyo. On a night in early 1703, snow covered the buildings, the streets, and the people who dared to brave the cold and venture outside. Oishi Yoshio, one of the key characters in our tale, wasn't sure he would live to see the end of this night. Not that it mattered, because even if things went according to his wishes, he would probably be dead before long anyway. But if things did go his way, and if that could be held at bay for just a little while, by dawn, the whiteness of the snow would be sprinkled with the blood of his enemies. The story we'll play with today is one of the most renowned revenge tales to come out of Japan. It's a tale that has been popularized in kabuki theater plays, and later in novels, movies, TV series. Even good old Keanu Reeves took a stab at it. One play about it began being performed in 1748, under the title Chushingura, and it's still part of the repertoire of kabuki plays regularly staged in Japan. No surprise, since this is one of the most celebrated events in Japanese history. Because of its iconic status, each retelling has muddled the waters, making it really difficult to separate history from myth and figure out what really happened. Sometimes referred to as the Ako incident, our story is perhaps more famously known as the tale of the 47 Ronin. Among most people who have been exposed to the story, the perception is that the 47 Ronin embodied the very essence of what it meant to be a samurai. Early Western sources were on board with the more romanticized accounts. These days, the 47 Ronin could use a better public relations machine. Among Westerners tackling this topic, the pendulum has swung very much in the other direction, and it's now popular instead to entirely dismiss anything remotely positive about the 47 Ronin, and present them as a bunch of violent thugs. In preparation for this episode, I've consulted lots of text and binge-listened to a couple of excellent podcasts about Japanese history, respectively entitled Samurai Archives and History of Japan. The official blog of the Samurai Archive Japanese History page definitely seem to endorse the more critical view of the 47 Ronin. There I read, "The picture that emerges seems to be that the Ronin were little different from a street gang carrying out a feudal drive-by." Okay then, looks like we have a bit of a historical mystery to tackle. Were the 47 Ronin paragons of samurai virtues? Or were they the murderous criminals with questionable motives who enjoy an undeserved reputation? Before we dive deep, I think it's only fair for me to confess my bias. Part of me badly wants to believe the more sensational versions of the story, because I'm quite partial to great storytelling, and this one has all the right elements. Problem is, I'm also partial to historical truth. And these two tendencies of mine may conflict a bit, because history and legend are highly mixed in the sources. So separating fact from fiction is a tricky business here. Most of my sources tend to be hypercritical of the legendary accounts. I'm not quite as convinced as they are in this regard. Whether it's because I disagree with the interpretation of the facts or because I'm blinded by my own bias, I don't know. I don't mean this as a cop-out or wanting to avoid taking a hard stance. But after researching this story, my perception is that the truth is somewhere in between. Many early sources are clearly heavily fictionalized for the sake of creating a cooler story out of historical facts. But the modern tendency to do a complete 180 is, in my opinion, rooted in a desire to seem smarter than the simpletons who are easily seduced by the more romantic accounts. So in this sense, the more you tear down the legend, the more real you appear. This is a rather common tendency among experts in a field, finding themselves facing the things that get the populace excited. Having said that, even though I may not fully agree with them, I really appreciate the work done by these guys in bringing a dose of reality to this tale. Before we can dive into the particulars of our tale and we're introduced to its key characters, it's going to be necessary to lay down the basics in order to understand the historical context. So a mini crash course in Japanese history is in order. Even a cursory look at Japan's history can show us that civil wars were quite frequent during the centuries preceding the particular story we focus on today, particularly between the late Heian period in the 1100s and all the way through the great wars of the Sengoku period, culminating in the Battle of Sekigahara in 1600. During most of these centuries, the emperor was little more than a figurehead. For the most part, real power rested with the shogun. Technically, the office of the shogun had been, you know, what that meant, what shogun was it was the title given to a commander-in-chief of an army during the duration of a campaign. In some way, it would not be too much of a stretch to compare it to the office of dictator in ancient Rome. A supreme command with much power, but only for a limited time, usually just for a campaign, before you would give up the position. But much changed during the civil wars of the 1100s, as powerful military leaders gained progressively more power. In 1192, Minamoto Yoritomo received a commission of shogun from the emperor. But unlike in the past, this was a permanent position. The office of shogun was transformed into a permanent military dictatorship, nominally ruling the country on behalf of the emperor, but the reality is that the emperor was little more than a ceremonial position, and had very little to say on how the shogun decided to run the show. Civil wars between various warlords became endemic from the late 1400s up to the beginning of the 1600s. But things changed drastically following the Battle of Sekigahara in 1600. The new shogun, Tokugawa Ieyasu, emerged triumphant from this long period of civil wars, consolidated power and reorganized the system. The period that followed is referred by some as the Edo period and by others as the Tokugawa period, since members of the Tokugawa family controlled the nation between 1600 and 1868. Our story takes place one century into this time, so let's dedicate a bit extra attention to it. The first Tokugawa shogun, Ieyasu, very much understood that gaining power is less than half the battle. Being able to hold on to power is a whole other game altogether. Literally centuries of civil wars preceded him, so he had little illusions that acquiring power meant he would get to keep it for long. Unless he could do something radical. So let's look at how Ieyasu went about playing the cards he was given, and how he was able to set up a system that would last for over two centuries. In the existing power structures, under the shogun were the daimyos, which were basically feudal lords ruling over their lands and having their own armies of faithful samurai. However, they were under the authority of the shogun. It was the out-of-control competition between power-hungry daimyos that had been at the roots of the wars of the previous decades. So Ieyasu had to do something to keep them in check. One step he took was to divide up the daimyos into different categories with different access to power. The shinpen were those daimyos related to the Tokugawa family. The fudai were vassals of the Tokugawa and their allies. And the tozama were those who had not been allied with Tokugawa before the Battle of Sekigahara, which usually meant they had stayed neutral. Not surprisingly, the Tozama had the least access to power. They couldn't hold government positions, they held lands far away from the capital of Edo, since obviously they were the least trustworthy. Edo, as I mentioned in the opening, was the capital, and that's the old name for today's Tokyo. According to some estimates, by the beginning of the 1700s, Edo had 2 million people, at a time when most cities in Europe were nowhere near this size. One of the first things Ieyasu did was to redistribute territories. Regardless of how long a certain daimyo had ruled over a particular territory, Ieyasu went about moving them around. He moved allies into better lands and former enemies into smaller territories. Now, this was, in addition to being a way to reward the most loyal daimyos, this was also a way to separate daimyos he didn't trust from their traditional power bases. Another step undertaken by one of Ieyasu's successors was to require the daimyos to maintain a palace in Edo and spend much of their time there so that the shogun could keep a close watch on them. Not exactly, but almost keeping them hostages. This system was called Sankinkotai, which refers to the alternate attendance system. Only some of the time, a daimyo would get to be in their own lands, whereas the rest of the time they would spend it in Edo. And usually, whereas daimyos went back and forth, their wives and their kids most often were required to stay in Edo all the time. Which, of course, is a way to, again, not technically keeping them hostages, is not declared in that fashion, but that's the reality, is that they were there so that if the daimyos were to rebel, he would know that his wife and kids would be in the hands of the shogun, which obviously was not a good idea. Another advantage of having the daimyos keep residence in Edo was that it forced them to spend lots of money to keep up appearances, so as not to have that much money stored up to organize a rebellion. You know, in Edo there were parties to be thrown, there were neighbors that you had to impress, you had to make sure that your house was as fancy as the next daimyos. You know, there were plenty of ways in which money would leave your hands and would leave your purse. So Edo was a money drain, clearly, and this was something that the shogun liked, because that meant that the daimyo would not have that money stored up to hire more soldiers for a rebellion or anything like that. Edo was kind of like a great golden cage for the daimyos. It was a place for networking and entertainment, so much so that most daimyos didn't want to go back to their homelands and liked to stay in Edo as much as they could. So they often had little to no contacts with the farmers working for them, since the farmers almost never left their home district, whereas the daimyos, most of the time, they would spend I mean, this varied, of course, throughout the Tokugawa period, and it varied from one particular case to another, but most of the time the daimyo would spend plenty of time in Edo, and in some cases really only reluctantly live in Edo, because that was the reality. Even though the system was set up to keep them in check and keep an eye on them and kind of keeping them hostage, it was a very luxurious type of setup. They would be in the center, you know, culturally, in terms of entertainment, in terms of everything else. Edo was the center of Japan. So many daimyos were not that happy to be leaving, not that thrilled with going back home. By the late 1600s, early 1700s, Japan had entered a period of political stability and economic prosperity. This, however, was a bit of a troubling time for the samurai, since they were a professional warrior class in a society where war was no longer a prime concern. After centuries of battles and conflict, now there were no more civil wars, and little in the way of external wars. So the reality was that the samurai were a big expense for the daimyos, but a largely useless one, since a large samurai retinue was redundant at a time of peace. To complicate things even further, at this time there was more class mobility than ever in the past, since merchants and middle classes now were often making more money than the samurai, and in some cases even than the nobility. So people who by rank stood higher on the totem pole sometimes were being surpassed in terms of wealth by those they considered their inferiors. Why am I telling you this story? Because this led to some serious soul-searching, as the samurai basically had to reinvent themselves, their position in society, and really their reasons to exist. Prior to the 1600s, the samurai were often illiterate, battle-hardened grunts. If you needed someone to stick a spear into someone else's guts, they were your kind of people. But if you wanted to discuss poetry and philosophy, as the more romanticized images of the samurai suggest the warriors were likely to do, well, then not so much before the 1600s. But in the peace times that followed the beginning of the 1600s, more emphasis was placed on Confucian literate education and on transforming the samurai from tough bastards who live for battle into gentlemen scholars, administrators, and ultimately bureaucrats who could get into a bit of commerce on the side to make ends meet. None of these, however, scream masculinity and warrior virtues, so some samurai were bothered by these changes. While the changes may have been inevitable, they mess with the samurai self-image as tough warriors. So as a reaction to the changing conditions, some samurai began emphasizing the notion of Bushido, or the way of the warrior, a code of ethics based primarily on Confucianism, that painted the role of the samurai as the very embodiment of bravery and loyalty. Texts such as the Hagakure, considered today among the classics of Bushido philosophy, help shape a very idealized image of the samurai, appealing to some golden age that probably never existed, and saying how in former times samurai used to be honorable and virtuous, but all that was getting lost during these softer, peaceful times. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that an author, like the author of the Hagakure or some of these other guys preaching these ideas, completely made up these notions. They were definitely based on seeds of truth that could find parallels in actual behavior in the past. Bravery and loyalty were clearly valued even prior to the Tokugawa period, but they were not nearly as normative as advertised. Real samurai rarely match the idealized image painted in books like the Hagakure. But the idealized image was necessary to justify the social position of the samurai at a time when actual need for samurai skills in war was at an all-time low. Generally speaking, now that the samurai didn't remind everyone of their usefulness through actual martial skills displayed on the battlefield, symbols of samurai identity became more important. Take the sword, for example. The shogun Tokugawa Ieyasu is supposed to have said that the sword was the soul of the samurai, and the laws of the Edo period reflected this. Commoners were officially forbidden from carrying swords, whereas the samurai could wear two swords, a longer one, the katana, and a shorter one, the wakizashi, something that became a status symbol for the samurai, including for those whose sedentary lifestyle would lead them to never draw a sword for combat. And yet, when it came to actual samurai warfare, the sword didn't really play quite as important a role as one would imagine. Contrary to popular images, the main samurai weapons on the battlefield had been the bow, usually shot from horseback, and the spear, plus pikes for foot soldiers. The sword was never more than a side weapon. If you are down to fighting with your sword, it's because things had gone horribly wrong. Kind of like using a pistol in warfare. I mean, can you use it? Sure. Do people use it? Sure. But of course, given a choice, there are plenty of other more powerful weapons one would use first. The sword became a much bigger deal during the peace times of the Edo period. Once there were no more battles and people didn't go around with spears, then swords became more practical since they made more sense in close quarters, and they were actually the kind of weapon one would carry around in civilian life. Much in the same way as Western gunslingers use pistols for duels, not because pistols are better weapons than rifles, of course, but because one was more likely to carry one in everyday life. If carrying around some awesome-looking swords was the upside of a samurai identity, a ritual disembowelment was the less fun part of the package. This peculiar form of ritual suicide existed among the samurai long before the Edo period, but it was at this time that it became much more formalized. Known as seppuku, or also in more colloquial languages, harakiri, it was done by sticking a sharp blade into the left side of the abdomen and cutting across. The obvious question that comes to mind when noting how much seppuku became intertwined with samurai identity is why. But why, as in, why kill yourself at all? And also as why in this particularly painful and brutal fashion? Seppuku, in fact, is not exactly a common practice shared by many cultures around the world. It is said that the origin of this custom may have been Chinese. You know, there are a few examples of suicide by disembowelment in ancient Chinese sources. But the prevalence of this idea in both theory and practice, however, is uniquely Japanese. I can't think of too many examples outside of Asia. Keito the Younger suicide in 46 before Common Era as an alternative to surrendering to Caesar seems to fit the bill. But other than that, not much comes to mind. The name of whoever had the bright idea to make this a thing in Japan is lost to history. Definitely must have been someone very convincing and quite charismatic, because clearly convincing folks that disembowelment is the way to go, it's a hard sell. I can almost imagine the conversation. Hey guys, you know what I just thought? We should make it a thing to commit suicide by sticking a blade in our bellies and ripping sideways. This could be a great cultural contribution that we could offer the world. Don't you guys think this is a great idea? Call me crazy, but that does not sound like the most appealing proposition I've ever heard. But let's answer the questions in order. Why did ritual suicide become such a popular custom among the samurai. Japanese culture being very precise and methodical, there are several different types of seppuku depending on the purpose. One would be the Kato the Younger rationale, you know, a defeated warrior choosing suicide in order to avoid having to surrender to his enemies. Another reason was grief. Pretty extreme grief, obviously. Seppuku is a form of deadly mourning for people choosing to follow their lord or a loved one in death. Another option was for a daimyo to commit seppuku for the sake of removing himself from a losing conflict in hope that his enemies, satisfied with his death, would spare his people. This actually happened not so rarely. The winning party in war would often require this as part of the terms of surrender. Meaning, you know, we'll treat your people okay, but you need to kill yourself. Okay, so far so good. But check out this rather peculiar one. Another form of seppuku would be seppuku as a form of protest against one's lord. Well, let's try that out again. How does that work? Well, criticizing one's own lord was clearly seen, it was considered unseemly for a samurai. And yet, sometimes a lord's behavior needed a good reality check. So what was a loyal samurai to do? Sticking a blade in one's stomach was the samurai way of saying, please, dear lord, change your ways. You couldn't really criticize your lord and continue living, but choosing to end one's life was the samurai way to state they meant business. Hirata Masahide, for example, was a samurai in the service of the Oda family and a tutor for Oda Nobunaga, a man destined to play a key role in Japanese history. Some sources tell us that in 1553, Masahide committed seppuku to protest the young Nobunaga's playboy ways and generally obnoxious behavior. Seeing his tutor with his guts spilled all over the place kind of shook up Nobunaga, who mourned the death of his teacher and rethought his life choices. Rather than being a playboy, he turned into one of the most bloodthirsty warlords to wreak havoc throughout Japan. Now, ask me, that's not an improvement, but what do I know? Number 5 on our list of reasons for seppuku was to prove one's innocence against unjust accusations. That's a bit intense, but I can see how he would deliver a message about one's sincerity. You know, people are always trying to justify themselves, and the feeling is, you may be lying to save your life. If you willingly end your life while at the same time protesting your innocence, that seems to, you know, the message there is pretty clear. It's like the guy is really innocent, so much so that he's willing to lay down his life to make a point. And number 6, we have seppuku as a form of execution. Authorities would basically sentence you to death, but out of respect for your samurai rank, they would grant you the honor of dying by your own hand, rather than being executed like any ordinary commoner. This particular rationale for seppuku will play a key role in the story I'm about to tell you, so keep this one fresh in mind. And speaking of keeping things fresh in mind, don't worry, I haven't forgotten I'm supposed to actually tell you a story. It's just that the story wouldn't make any sense without first giving you a bit of info on the cultural and historical context. So bear with me for a while longer, but I swear I will get there. But before I get to our story, allow me to keep exploring the seppuku ritual. Last but definitely not least for the reasons for seppuku is my personal favorite. Okay, I just heard the words that came out of my mouth and that really didn't come out well. I think it's safe to say that by the time I'm picking favorites for the best reasons to disembowel oneself, I've probably spent a bit too much time researching this stuff. But indulge me. Among the possible reasons why a samurai committed seppuku was taking responsibility for a mistake. Let me repeat that a second. One of the reasons why a samurai would commit seppuku was taking the responsibility for a mistake. I'm so used to seeing people always looking for justifications and doing anything in the world to avoid taking responsibility, that even though I don't necessarily advocate seppuku to anyone, I'm actually impressed by the idea of seppuku as a way to acknowledge one's failings. Personally, I don't follow too many rules or social customs. But one thing I take monstrously seriously is giving my word. To me, one's word is sacred. And I really don't see how somebody who breaks one's word can look at themselves in the mirror and find a way to justify to themselves continuing to draw breath and enjoy the privilege of life on earth. To me, someone who breaks their word can never be trusted again and ultimately lacks any honor. You just don't do that, ever, for any reason. I can't stand hearing people who play fast and loose with their word, then apologizing and asking for forgiveness. In my view, when it comes to one's word, one mistake is one too many. You can't just say sorry and expect it to go away. I mean, I'll catch you some slack if you are 5 years old, but past that, not so much. So, given how big of a deal this is to me, I confess that I'm impressed with people whose way of saying sorry I made a mistake is to stick a sharp blade in their abdomen. I dig this degree of deadly sincerity when it comes to one's ideals. Okay, so regardless of whether you agree with me or you think I've spent way too many nights reading books about seppuku and have now turned into a complete sociopath, I think you now have some ideas for why the samurai embrace ritual suicide. But we still haven't answered why suicide in this particularly painful way. Disembowelment, in fact, is one of the most painful and least efficient ways possible to kill oneself. There are many less painful, less ugly, and faster ways to terminate one's earthly existence. It's very possible to cut oneself open without severing any major artery, which means that death will come slowly after possibly hours of agony. So this question is a lot harder to answer. I'm sure for most samurai it wasn't a conscious choice as much as it was simply following tradition. And the guys who started this cheerful custom didn't leave behind detailed explanations for why they thought this was a good idea. A theory I heard revolves around the Japanese belief that the hara, which can be loosely but imperfectly translated as the abdomen, is the source of all vital energy. So sticking a blade in such a spot is a way to free the spirit from the body and let one's vital energy out. Another theory is tied to the concept of spilling your guts, which is something we use in the English language as well. Symbolically speaking, spilling your guts means revealing the truth, having nothing to hide, being completely sincere. So you can see how this idea can be connected to the notion of vindicating one's honor. Seems clear to me that someone missed the metaphor there and took the concept of spilling your guts a bit too literally. But you see where I'm going with this. Far from being sinful or shameful, dying by one's own hand was seen as a way to preserve one's honor. Samurai culture, at least in theory, was all about defeating the fear of death, both in battle and in the course of ritual suicide. Much in the same way that samurai trained to overcome their fear of death in combat, They also train to perform seppuku at a moment's notice, so that if the occasion called for it, they wouldn't be compromising their honor. Some samurai families literally held, I mean, this may sound really weird, well, not that all the stuff I've mentioned so far doesn't, but some samurai families literally held seppuku practices for the men, women, and even the kids. You know, a cheerful family affair. I can picture some old grumpy samurai complaining about the younger generations. Something that older generations have done since the dawn of times. In the samurai case, I can picture our grumpy old guy saying, "Kids today no longer spend time with their family like we did when we were kids. They would rather go off on their own and be with their friends, rather than spend the evening practicing a ritual disembowelment with mother, father, siblings, cousins. What's wrong with them?" You know, no matter how insane this may sound to people not raised within the culture, the training was apparently incredibly effective. And most records speak of samurai committing seppuku without betraying any sign of fear or hesitation. During the Edo period, seppuku was becoming a more formal affair, and was also changing in substantial ways. The samurai was about to commit seppuku, was expected to compose a death poem. I'll give you a few examples of the kind of poetry that was considered appropriate before spilling one's guts all over the place. Uesugi Kenshin was a great daimyo who didn't commit seppuku, but nonetheless in 1578 composed the death poem that read, "49 years of sleep and dreams, a long and fruitful life, it was nothing but a cup of sake." The military commander Shimizu Muneharu in 1582 wrote his death poem before committing seppuku. "The best time to die," he wrote, "is when the whole world is against you. Fall at that moment and you will blossom like a flower." But my all-time favorite when it comes to death poems belong to the Zen monk Kanzawa Toko, who must have been in a really cranky mood when he sat down to write his death poem, since he reads, "Death poems are a delusion. You just die." That's hilarious, man. This is just, "Death poems are a delusion. You just die." Or in an alternate translation, "Death poems are mere delusion. Death is death." On that happy note, let me add one more thing about seppuku. In pre-Edo days, in fact, seppuku may have started as a form of suicide, but as time went by, people realized how horribly inefficient, horrendously painful, and flat-out gross it was. So they changed the ritual around to include a kaishakunin, who was basically an assistant who would cut off the head of the person performing seppuku for the sake of sparing them incredible pain. In this format, seppuku would be a form of assisted suicide via beheading, rather than suicide in the strict sense of the word. Sometimes the kaishakunin would perform their duty after the person committing seppuku had started the initial cut. Sometimes they stepped in even earlier, when the person just touched the blade, or sometimes even earlier when they were simply reaching for the blade. In many cases, the kaishakunin was a friend of the samurai wishing to die. You know how if two guys are really close, one may ask the other to be the best man at their wedding? Japanese culture being what it was, your good friend may ask you not to play a key role at their wedding, but to be the guy who would cut off their head and spare him prolonged agonies of ritual disembowelment. "Would you be a pal and cut my head off during my ritual suicide?" "Yes, thank you. I know I could count on you." In any case, long story short, during the Edo period, seppuku was another way for the samurai to emphasize how they were different from other citizens and from lowly peasants. It was a status symbol to distinguish themselves from the unwashed masses. Maybe they didn't die in battle on a regular basis anymore. And yes, maybe in those days they were becoming bureaucrats more than warriors. But they could still die like warriors, facing death fearlessly, with an act of ritual suicide. So seppuku was very much tied with honor, and was part of the very fabric of samurai identity. Okay, so it was a really long road to get here, but here we are. It's time to introduce you to some of the characters in our tale. Let's start with the big boss. The shogun at the time of our tale was the fifth of the Tokugawa dynasty, Tokugawa Tsunayoshi, great-grandson of Ieyasu. Born in 1646, Tsunayoshi was shogun between 1680 and 1709. Under his rule, the movement to turn samurai from warriors to bureaucrats, that I mentioned earlier, was well underway. Tsunayoshi is remembered with the curious nickname of the Dog Shogun, because he was a big-time animal lover, and he put in place stringent laws to protect animal rights, dogs in particular. Sick animals could not be abandoned. Cruelty to animals could lead to prison. Thinking of killing a dog, you're looking at either the death penalty or exile. For example, in 1686, a guy killed a swallow, so he was executed and his kids were exiled. So yes, you can say that our shogun took the concept of animal rights rather seriously. Next in our list of key characters at the beginning of this tale is Asano Naganori. By the way, when I'm reading you guys' names, keep in mind that I'm trying to go with the Japanese custom of using the last name first. So, you know, whereas we would say Joe Smith, Japanese would use Smith Joe. So Asano Naganori, Asano being the last name and Naganori being the first name. Asano was born in 1667. He was the daimyo of the Ako domain in the southern portion of Japan. He was in his mid-30s at the time of the 1701 incident. The Asano family had served Toyotomi Hideyoshi during the civil wars, with Asano Nagamasa even being a brother-in-law of Hideyoshi. Hideyoshi, by the way, was one of the shogun at the time. Well, that's actually complicated, that's getting me into trouble, but he was one of the key political figures at that time. Later, however, the Asano clan made the smart move of joining with Tokugawa forces. So the Asano daimyo in our story, Naganori, was the great-grandson of Nagamasa. Contemporary sources regarding this particular Asano, written down before the incident at the roots of our story, describe him as intelligent, but, I quote, given to pleasure in preference of the sober business of government. The image that emerges from the sources is that of a playboy primarily interested in sex with as many ladies as possible and really not in a whole lot else. The same sources criticize Asano retainers for failing to educate him, to educate their daimyo in proper behavior. You get the feeling that the authors writing about Asano wouldn't have minded if one of Asano's men had sliced and diced himself in ritual seppuku for the sake of correcting their lord's behavior, much in the same vein as the samurai under Oda Nobunaga, whom I referred to earlier. But apparently no one in Asano's service was in a slice and dice mode. It's actually very hard to tell whether his retainers were really at fault or not. Maybe they had tried, but he wouldn't listen to reason, or maybe they figured that letting him amuse himself with ladies and drink would leave them free to run the show on their own. Or maybe there are lots of maybes. Fact is, we don't know what the dynamics between the retainers and Asano were. Both those who make apologies for his retainers and their critics are really speaking out of turn. since it's complete speculation. Okay, so now that you have been introduced to the Shogun and to Asano, let's look at the genesis of the incident destined to capture popular imagination for centuries to come. In 1701, the Shogun selected two daimyos to host the representatives of the emperor who were coming to visit the Shogun. This was part of an annual ceremony, which basically reestablished the idea that the emperor fully supported the Shogun. It was a way to justify, at least symbolically, the source of the Shogun's power. So needless to say, this was a big deal. There was lots of pressure on the two daimyos to make sure everything would run smoothly. The daimyos in question were, you guessed it, Asano, along with a gentleman named Date Muneharu. Some sources, by the way, give the name Kamei Korechika, but all evidence I've seen seems to indicate this is incorrect. Events like this one were characterized by much ritual and formality. So, to make sure things would work out well, Asano and Date were to receive proper instruction on court etiquette and all other details that went into the ceremony by a master of ceremonies appointed by the Shogun, another key character in our drama, named Kira Yoshinaka, in many sources. However, it seems like this may be a mistake that was repeated afterwards. Most of the more accurate evidence I've seen indicates that his name was probably Kira Yoshihisa. I'm sure that your day will be dramatically altered on whether the guy was named Yoshinaka or Yoshihisa, but you know, nerdy historical stuff. We got to pay attention to details. Kira was born in 1641, so he was just around 60 years old at this time. He was from a samurai family, but long gone were the days when members of his family had seen any battles. Instead, he held the role of head of ceremonial matters, a position he had inherited from his father. The master of shogunal ceremony supervised court protocol, organized audiences with the shogun, and other stuff like that. The job required a manic degree of precision and attention to details, since official ceremonies had to flow smoothly down to the last detail, and Japanese court etiquette was all about the details. So far, so good. The part I just mentioned is something that we have solid historical information for. Our next solid piece of historical information is that there will be a major problem between Kira and Asano. The part in between, however, that's where we enter the land of speculation based on very little evidence. People have been trying to connect the dots, letting their fantasy fly, but the reality is we simply don't know. In any case, let me tell you how kabuki plays and popular history tell what happened next. The popular theory is that the daimyos didn't give enough gifts to Kira. And you know, this was a big deal, because formal gift giving to someone teaching you was customary. Some sources say, you know, they consider that the daimyo's refusal to pay Kira as a principled stance against corruption, and they accuse Kira of demanding bribes. Other believes that the daimyos were just being cheap, and that it was perfectly normal to pay a good amount for the kind of service Kira was providing. The legendary account also tells us that Kira was being rude, supposedly making fun of Asano for being a country bumpkin with no manners. The same legendary accounts tell us also that the other daimyo, Date Muneharu, wanted to attack Kira for his rudeness, but Asano was actually the one who calmed him down. Eventually, the story goes, Date's representative paid a huge bribe without their lord knowing, or so they say, and Kira began treating him better, whereas Asano refused to pay and kept being the target of Kira's anger. Keep in mind, all of what I'm telling you here is complete speculation. The only primary source on the genesis of the conflict between Kira and Asano doesn't tell us any reason for it. The idea of Kira as a corrupt official demanding bribes becomes a key piece in the storyline that will be popularized through countless kabuki theater plays. And in light of what will happen next, it makes for a much better story. But as I mentioned, we have no evidence for it. What we do have evidence for is that on a day in April 1701, Asano lost his temper and did something that would have repercussions on the lives of hundreds of people. The only eyewitness account is from a certain Kajikawa Yosobei, an official in the castle, who was talking with Kira inside a part of Edo Castle called the Corridor of Pines. When Asano showed up screaming, "Have you forgotten my grievance from these past days?" and drawing his wakizashi, which in case you're not up to speed on the proper nomenclature for Japanese swords, the wakizashi is the shorter of the two swords customarily worn by the samurai. The blade was typically between 30 and 60 centimeters, which is basically means between 12 and 24 inches. It was used for close quarter fighting and for ritual suicide. The katana, on the other hand, the main sword, was considerably longer. In any case, Asano drew his wakizashi, attacked Kira from behind, wounding him in the back. When Kira turned around, Asano slashed him in the face. Kajikawa bravely jumped forward, blocking Asano from finishing the job, and other samurai quickly arrived and subdued Asano, who kept repeating he had problems with Kira, and even though he regretted the time and place, he felt he had no choice but to strike him. A statement that does preciously little to shed light on what exactly was the nature of the conflict. Similarly useless for the purpose of understanding what caused him to lash out is the message Asano requested to be passed on to his retainers. All the message said was, "I should have informed you about this matter in advance, but what happened today could not be helped, and it was impossible for me to let you know." Again, Asano, not very helpful. The more romanticized version from the kabuki plays tell us that Asano was pushed to the limits by Kira's taunts, so he snapped but restrained himself and only gave him a small cut, not intending to kill him. Other versions suggest that Asano was a goof with no understanding of how to use the weapons he carried and managed to fail killing an unarmed older man. Had he known what he was doing, he would have stabbed Kira with the sword, since this dramatically increased the odds of killing rather than slashing. In either case, drawing a blade in Edo Castle was a big no-no and was a death penalty offense. Doing something like that on the day when an important ceremony was to take place and the emissaries of the emperor were in the palace, I mean, talk about bad timing. The shogun was not a big believer in the notion of trial, conviction, appeal, counter-appeal, counter-counter-appeal, and maybe, if old age hadn't killed you by then, maybe execution after years on death row. The shogun had a bit of a speedier approach about the death penalty. Within a few hours on the same day, he asked Asano to commit seppuku. And when I say ask, I don't mean make a request that anybody could turn down. It was the classic offer you can't refuse kind of thing. Seppuku was an honor afforded to Asano because of his status. Had he been a common criminal, he would have ended his days through some more brutal form of execution. Suicide was considered more dignified. As I mentioned earlier, to make seppuku less atrocious and avoid cases of people surviving disembowelment for many hours, there was almost always a second facilitating the process. After the first thrust of the knife into the gut, the second would cut the head off to bring suffering to an end. After the sentence was passed, and before it was carried out, with the formalism that characterized suicide in Japan. Asano first wrote his death poem, because, you know, it was considered bad form to stick a short sword in your stomach in an act of ritual suicide, unless you had first waxed poetically about cherry blossoms or something like that. In Asano's case, thoughts of impending disembowelment mess his creativity up, so his poem was actually about the most cliché of topics, yes, you guessed it, cherry blossoms. The poem read, "More than the cherry blossoms, inviting a wind to blow them away, I'm wondering what to do with the remaining springtime." Well, the shogun was going to resolve this problem for him. The order was to commit seppuku immediately, so Asano wouldn't have to wonder what to do with the remaining springtime, since he would have none. Asano was in custody at the residence of Lord Tamura Dateaki. According to some sources, Asano asked if Kira was dead, and he seemed pleased when Tamura told him what he wanted to hear, lying that Kira was horribly wounded and likely to die, which wasn't true at all. After the seppuku, Tamura sent a messenger to Asano's brother. The message read something like this: "Sir, this is to inform you that your brother, Lord Asano Naganori, has just this moment disemboweled himself at my residence, in the presence of Chief Inspector Tsuchiya and two other officials. As next of kin, you are respectfully requested to come and collect the body at your earliest convenience." I love how polite it all sounds, when the reality of what it's trying to say is, "Hey man, your brother's guts are spilled all over my garden. Can you please come scrape him off my floor, because it's beginning to stink?" In addition to throwing away his own life, Asano's impulsive attack on Kira would have tremendously negative consequences on his family and on his retainers. The shogun order for Asano's brother, who was the new head of the family, to be placed under house arrest, and for their family lands to be confiscated. So far, this story doesn't seem to contain the seeds of one of the most enduring archetypal events in Japanese history. All we have is a daimyo pulling a blade for unknown reasons on a court official and being executed for his troubles. It seems like the story could end here in a rather uneventful manner. Mundane, not particularly exciting. Something that could and should leave hardly a trace in history. But that's because we haven't seen yet what will happen once news of the daimyo's death will reach his samurai. We've barely introduced the key character in our story, Oishi Yoshio, and his 46 companions, whose actions will become synonymous in Japanese popular culture with loyalty and revenge. So whatever you do, don't miss out on the finale of the 47 Ronin story. But many of you have tuned into this 47 Ronin story, hoping for a great revenge tale, and now I feel like I'm leaving you hanging until next month. That doesn't seem right. On the other hand, I really cannot try to wrap it all up in one episode, because I'm running behind with research. So, what to do, how I can try to give you at least a little taste of what you are looking for, while at the same time having had the time to set up this story but concluding it next month. Well, to satisfy your revenge appetite, here is a tasty morsel. This is a short, self-contained story that I probably would have otherwise not found a home for, and the only reason why I'm telling it to you is because we are breaking up the episode in two. So before I leave you for this month, I want to tell you this quick tale that also comes from Japanese history. Well, okay, possibly history. Much like the 47 Ronin story, This one is a staple for kabuki plays, but as Isaac Mayer from the History of Japan podcast pointed out to me, there's a whole unsolved debate on how much of this is history and how much is legend. Unfortunately, sometimes historians can't separate one from the other with certainty. So with this caveat in mind, let's go play. The story revolves around a samurai named Shiga Daishichi, who was running from the law because of some misdemeanor that the sources where I found this story, they didn't tell us exactly what he had done, but it was something relatively minor. It wouldn't have been that big of a deal if he got busted. But good Shiga Daishichi was a bit paranoid and wasn't thinking straight. So when he realized that there was a farmer just, you know, working in the fields, doing his thing, who spotted him when Shiga had gone to hide in such fields, Shiga decided to kill him, which was really a dumb idea for multiple reasons. On a moral level, he completely overreacted. You know, he was, up until now, he was only guilty of a fairly small crime. Now he committed murder. So bad thinking all around. So Shiga is not the hero of our story. You can by now be safe of that. Turns out that the farmer Shiga murdered had two daughters named Miyagino and Shinobu. Or at least, according to one of the versions that I've read, he had two daughters. In some of the other versions, there was only one. But in any case, Miyagino had become a prostitute in the Yoshiwara Red Light District. Yoshiwara was kind of like the most renowned red light district in all of Japan. And Miyagino had gone there because her family was incredibly poor, and so she was trying to make ends meet. Her sister, Shinobu, went to tell her what happened. Now, clearly there are some missing pieces in this story, since we don't know how Shinobu knew that samurai Shiga was the one who killed her father. You know, if Shiga had killed the only witness there, how, well, we don't know, really. Like, all the versions I've read are missing some of the details. But here is where the story gets interesting. The two sisters decide they want revenge. However, their odds of gaining revenge on a samurai are pretty slim. So what they do is that they decide to invest some time trying to learn from the fiancé of Shinobu. Because her fiancé was a samurai. And so they decide, hey, can you teach us? Can you teach us how to fight? And supposedly, Shinobu's fiancé decide to go for it, say, yes, I will teach you. So they spend an undetermined amount of time studying with this guy, learning how to use weapons, learning how to fight. And in 1649, supposedly they went to ask the local daimyo for permission to avenge their father. Now, this is a big deal, by the way, and it will be tied to the 47 Ronin story, because there was a legal way to gain revenge in Japan. If the proper authorities gave you permission, you could go out and hunt down the person you wanted revenge against. As we're going to see in the next episode, this is absolutely going to be impossible for the 47 Ronin to do. Because the reality is that the people they want to get revenge against, you know, they would never get permission from the shogun. That just wouldn't happen. But in this particular case, the local daimyo listen to this, say, well, yeah, this guy killed your father, so I'm gonna allow it. Whatever was going through his head, we're not entirely sure, but he decided to allow it, to let it go. And he decided, well, you know, the samurai has spent his whole life training. You guys have only had a relatively short amount of time. So to make this more fair, I'm gonna allow both of you to fight against him at the same time. And also it seems fair, because after all, he killed the man who was the father to both of you, not just to one of you. So, okay, it's going to be two against one. The two sisters had trained, Miyagino supposedly had trained with the naginata, which is this, basically a long pole with a very sharp blade at the end, kind of like a halberd or something along those lines in Western terms. Whereas Shinobu trained with a much more esoteric weapon, the kusarigame, which was essentially a sharpened sickle with a weighed chain at the end of it. And the whole point of this, if you've never seen it, Google it. It's called Kusari Game, Kusari, and then the word game, spelled like game. Weird looking weapon. And the whole point of it was to use the chain to try to entangle the opponent weapon and then use the sickle to cut them down. So off they go. The samurai pulls out his sword. The two sisters get their weapons ready. Shinobu uses the Kusari Game to during one of the first attack, when the samurai starts swinging his sword, Shinobu uses the Kusari Game, the chain part, to capture the samurai sword and entangle it. And while the samurai is busy trying to get his weapon free, Miyagino just cut him down with her naginata. Talk about a serious tale of revenge right there. I love this one. I mean, the odds that historically things went exactly as the legend tells it? Probably not. Maybe something like this happened. Again, very hard to tell when something becomes part of popular folklore, where the legend ends and history begins. It's possible that there may be some seed to it. Again, hard to tell the exact amount. But I just had to tell you, because this was a glorious story. You know, the idea of the two sisters who train with these two rather esoteric weapons to go fight against the samurai. That's just a great story right there. I told this tale to my 8-year-old daughter, and their response to it was to promise me that if anyone kills me, she'll hunt them down and cut them down as the sisters had done for their father in this story. Okay, so now that your revenge buds have hopefully been satisfied with this appetizer, get ready for the main course coming up in a month, when the 47th Ronin will get to the business that made them legendary figures in Japanese history. Big thank you to a couple of gentlemen who have decided to sponsor History on Fire on Patreon at the $50 level. The prize is having your name horribly mispronounced with an Italian accent, and the recipients of such prize are Justin Maples and Ross Enriquez. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Those of you guys who hate ads, and Patreon is the way to go, $5 a month on Patreon helps the podcast stay afloat, and you will be receiving ad-free copy of the episodes. And $10 a month, you get them about 5 days before everyone else. There are different tiers with different rewards for your support, so if you feel in a generous mood, you want to check out Patreon, that would be sweet. The link to my account is in the episode notes. If you do not mind ads, then let's go thank you, the sweet, nice folks who have sponsored this episode. Let's start with Blue Chew. At BlueChew.com you find the first chewable with the same FDA-approved active ingredients as Viagra and Cialis. Their stuff is made in the US, prescribed online, and ships straight to your door. Their goodies work well even on a full stomach, and since they are chewable, they work up to twice as fast as a pill. It is my personal belief that armed with some Blue Chew support, lots of people would have been considerably happier and more fulfilled in their lives and wouldn't have felt the need to go conquer 72 other countries or start massacres or do a lot of the nasty things that seem to reoccur a lot throughout human history. But that's just my belief. What is not my belief, what is a fact, is that right now Blue Chew has a special deal for our listeners. If you visit bluechew.com, you can get your first shipment free, always a cool concept, when you use the promo code HISTORY. Just pay $5 for shipping. Again, that's bluechew.com, promo code HISTORY to try it for free. This episode is also brought to you by blueapron.com. In these weeks, in June, Blue Apron is teaming up with best-selling cookbook author Chrissy Teigen to bring you some of her favorite recipes to make at home. So for the next few weeks, that's what a lot of the Blue Apron recipes that people have access to will be based on. With Blue Apron, you get ridiculously tasty pre-portioned ingredients shipped straight to your door with easy-to-follow step-by-step instruction. They really make cooking so much easier. They take a lot of the guesswork away, and it really becomes, like, even if you're not an amazing chef to start with, it becomes, I wouldn't say easy, because nothing that requires skill is easy, but as easy as it's going to get to cook some amazing food. They offer 12 recipes a week, and it's up to you to decide how many you want, whether 2, 3, or 4. So right now, there's a special offer for History on Fire listeners. If you check out this week's menu, you can get your first 3 meals for free at blueapron.com/onfire. Again, that's blueapron.com/onfire to get your first 3 meals free. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. This episode is also brought to you by the Must Triumph podcast. Sam Yang is somebody I know personally. He's the author of the Must Triumph podcast. He's also a fellow martial artist, and he happens to be a brilliant guy. You know, anytime getting sponsored by another podcast is always tricky, because especially if you don't know them well or you don't have a history with them, you may just listen to an episode here and there. It's always a little more difficult, but in Sam's case, it's really not like that. Because I know the man, and I've actually had a chance to check out all of his episodes so far. So I can personally vouch that he's a brilliant guy with a sharp mind. The theme of his podcast is self-improvement. Based on, you know, his thing is any idea that delivers tangible results is one worth exploring. So his approach is philosophical, but not in a pedantic, academic way. Philosophical in a more street-oriented, result-driven kind of philosophy. And by result, I mean the result is simple. It's one. It's elevating the quality of life. That's the goal of the game. He speaks extremely well. I very much enjoy all the episodes so far, so check him out at the Must Triumph podcast. Big thank you also to my regular sponsor, Onnit and Datsusara. If you go at onnit.com, that's onnit.com/history, you can get an automatic discount on a whole range of products. There's supplements alone, there's enough there to keep you busy for days. There's so much good stuff. But besides supplements, they also have a lot of other great programs, from online workouts that you can get, from workout gear, from clothing, to special foods. Really, it's an extremely eclectic company. The only common thread is high quality. And speaking of high quality, great folks at Datsusara are always awesome. I use their bags every single day. Finest hemp gear you can find. When I go training martial arts, my gi is a Datsusara hemp gi. When I go to school to teach, I'm carrying a Datsusara computer bag. When, you know, my wallet is a Datsusara wallet. I use their products all the time. So go check them out at dsgear.com. That's the letter D, the letter S, the word gear.com. Great, great stuff. And last but not least, I want to give a shout out to NeverTapGear.com. NeverTapGear, right now they are primarily focusing on providing knee braces for people working out who want to keep their joints all in one piece and have some extra support. They are going to be adding things. There's soon going to be also rash guards and other products for sale there. But for right now, knee braces is where it's at. So check them out. Having said all that, I want to thank you for your attention. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for telling other people about this podcast, for writing reviews. You guys are awesome. Thank you. Have a beautiful day.